Hi, I'm Amy.
And I'm Jess, and we're the Rambling Ravenpuffs.
Because Potterheads are far too nuanced to be shoved into just one Hogwarts house.
Each week, we will cover two chapters in the saga of our favorite boy wizard.
All the while exploring literary themes, tarot card exercises, and even fanfic speculations.
To connect with us, your fabulous host, and other listeners, join our Facebook group, the Ravenpuff Common Room, and on Instagram at the Rambling Ravenpuffs.
And to support the podcast and gain access to exclusive bonus features, consider joining our Patreon page at patreon.com/therambling ravenpuffs, all lowercase.
Thank you for tuning in. Grab your butterbeer and enjoy the show.
Welcome again to the Rambling Ravenpuffs. Welcome to the show, everyone. I'm Amy.
And I'm Jess.
And today we're covering chapters 9 and 10 of The Chamber of Secrets, The Writing on the Wall, and The Rogue Ledger. In these chapters, Harry learns that the Slytherin house isn't just bad news for its Machiavellian approach to life, but ethnic purity has been baked into its very foundations. And gasp, another Muggleborn has been attacked. And joining us for this episode is a very special guest speaker. Please welcome Dr. Andrew Mills. Hi, Andrew.
Hello. Thanks for having me on the show.
Of course. Andrew is a professor of philosophy at Otterbein University. His teaching interests are wide-ranging, everything from logic to Socrates to existentialism. What ties his academic pursuits to Harry Potter is that he was a contributor in the Ultimate Harry Potter and Philosophy book published in 2010. The seventh chapter of this book consists of Andrew's article titled Patriotism, House Loyalty, and the Obligations of Belonging, where he poses questions of nationalism, patriotism, and tribalism within the context of this wizarding world. Again, thank you so much for joining us, Andrew.
It's my pleasure to be here.
So what was your first thoughts when you got my email, just some random ladies, like, you know, asking about your article from 10 years ago?
I was excited that somebody read it. You know, we write these articles and then they just go off into the world. And you know, the article in this book has more of a chance of being read because it's a book that's sold in, you know, Barnes & Noble and regular bookstores and not some academic article that sits on library shelves forever. But it was great. And to get your email and to know that somebody read the piece and liked it. And it enabled me, gave me an opportunity to go back and reread the piece and to reread the Harry Potter books. I haven't read them in years. So that was fun. It was great. And as I was rereading the piece, I was thinking, wow, there's some interesting stuff here and there's interesting stuff in the book. So it was great. And I should say, I also, I used to teach a course, a Harry Potter and philosophy course, at Otterbein, we call them freshman year seminars. Sort of a lot of universities have courses like this for students that aren't, it's not just for philosophy majors. It's for anyone. So we talked about a whole bunch of philosophical topics through the Harry Potter books. I haven't taught that course for a long time, but it made me eager to revive it. Though I don't know, like today's college students, you know, Harry Potter is not as current as it used to be. You know, when I taught the course, whenever it was, 10 years ago, 8 years ago, you know, a lot of the students grew up on the Harry Potter books, and I'm not quite sure if the 18-year-olds nowadays were reading Harry Potter when they were 10 or 12 or 14.
All righty then. So Jess, what were your first impressions of these chapters?
Well, first of all, I'm very jealous I didn't get to take that class. I know, like, I'm new to new to the books, but I really love, like, integrating philosophy with, like, pop culture. I think it definitely helps my understanding of a lot of things. So I think that I would like to first off say there was great relief for me in the beginning of this chapter. I know Mrs. Norris is not, like, super well loved, but she's still a cat. And I've said many times I'm an animal lover. So knowing that she wasn't completely gone was good. The second chapter, I'm glad it wasn't just a straight up Quidditch chapter, because I think my feelings toward Quidditch chapters are pretty solid at this point. I just kind of, the words kind of, you know, I kind of do the thing where I'm like, I know words went by, but I don't know what I read. So that chapter turned out to be really interesting. And I loved how the students kind of got the history teacher to share what the Chamber of Secrets was all about. So yeah, that was my, what about you all's like rereading of it?
Yes, Andrew, again, you haven't touched these books in years. Yeah. So what was it going back to these two specific chapters?
Something struck me as reading this, and I know I'm reading this from the, you know, position of a humanities professor, but it always sort of galled me a little bit that the history teacher is the most boring teacher, you know, that here's the person in the book who's closest, who does what, you know, closest to what I do for a living, and that they hate the class, and he's dead, or he died in the middle of teaching, and he didn't even know he was dead, and it's just drudgery. And so I've experienced classes like this, and I'm sure there are some of my colleagues who teach classes like this, but I wish sometimes that the humanities teachers didn't get such a, such a bad showing in the book, that we could do more exciting things in our classes. So that struck me again. But I think I also, I'm with you, Jess, on the Quidditch chapters.
Good.
That it's like, okay, we get it. Let's move on. And I think many of the Quidditch chapters do serve the plot in some way or other. There's something like in the chapter today, there's something that happens in the Quidditch match that sort of is more than just Quidditch, but you kind of want to like enough, let's get to the point here. Enough of bludgers and seekers and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. So the way we typically do this is kind of go scene by scene within the chapters. So of course, the first thing that happens is we pick up exactly where we left off in chapter 8, where the teachers, well, first Filch finds the cat and he is irate with sorrow and rage and literally is about to like immediately turns to Harry and is less like, you. But then luckily the trio are rescued by the other teachers, Dumbledore. It's always Dumbledore, McGonagall, and Snape. They're always a trio together.
The other golden trio. Like, I think it was pretty interesting that Filch was like, oh, obviously it was Harry Potter that did this. I'm like, what behavior has made you ever think? Like, yeah, he's done some weird things, but nothing like intentionally harming something. So that was a little weird to me.
Well, I think, you know, my theory on that is because in a sad way, even though, yeah, it's completely out of character for Harry again to do such a thing, I think Filch is operating on the sense of he knows the prejudices of this world and he knows Harry is the most recent person to discover that he was a squib and therefore presumed that, of course, this type of anti-Muggle or anti-Muggle heritage, you know, bullying/terrorism... is directed at me because he did it.
And like Harry doesn't even know what the hell that word means, which neither did I. So Harry and I were in the same boat there for a minute.
I found myself having to look up again what squib meant. And I was, because I just dipped in to read these two chapters and I had to think, was I supposed to know this already? And so, or, you know, and then it gets explained to us later, but I did find myself on my phone sort of looking up squib and reminding myself of what a squib meant.
I have to say, I would be pretty bummed to be a squib. Like that, you know, kind of exciting to find out that you're a wizard from Muggle parents, to find out that you have wizard parents and like you can't do anything. Like, what a drag.
Right.
So bummed.
Right. And you're spending your life like in with the wizards, like that he can't just go get a custodial job in the Muggle world or whatever kind of job.
Right.
Like it's particularly then like just in his face all the time, what he lacks.
And it makes me wonder what his deal is, because it kind of leaves the suggestion that maybe Dumbledore has taken on Filch as, I don't know, if pity, like, or maybe at the very least protection in a way. But at the same time, he's just in a position that it's obvious it's going to make him miserable. Yeah. The Golden Professor trio, Dumbledore, Minerva, and Snape are there. And then also Gilderoy Lockhart is there. And his office is closest. And so they all reconvene in Gilderoy Lockhart's office. And I reread this chapter thinking, you know, just how dark Gilderoy Lockhart's narcissism is. Because it's played off so much as superficial comic relief. But if you think about it, just the real narcissism and lack of empathy that it takes, where, you know, Filch, who is not known to be in touch with his emotional side, is literally sobbing and is so emotionally distraught. And still Lockhart can't read the room enough to be like, I should probably shut up right now.
I feel like I know some, like, this was an example of some people I know, like Lockhart's behavior. I was like, dude, just shut up for 5 minutes.
It's not about you at this moment.
Yeah, right. It's not about you. But he's so, like, I don't know. He's this, again, this is from my read of, like, not knowing what's going to happen. But he seems so, like, intent on impressing everyone. And I love how Dumbledore, who we all know has my heart fully, it is just so like, dude, whatever. I know what I'm doing. And this guy's back here rambling. And I love his confidence. That's what I love about Dumbledore. One of the many things.
I think as well, that one thing I really love about Dumbledore is he always keeps his head about him, right? So mm-hmm. Here's Filch. Like, obviously, there's his cat and he thinks it's dead. And so he's very emotional about it. And Dumbledore's all business and compassionate, but sort of all business about it. And Lockhart's being sort of self-involved, and Dumbledore kind of gets down to business. And he just doesn't let himself get swept up in the sort of problematic, excitements or of some of these other people who, they're grown-ups, right? They should know better. Right. Lockhart should know better.
Yeah. I admire that cool-headedness that yes. Dumbledore has. I wish I could be that way. Don't know if I'm quite there yet.
Yeah. And Dumbledore goes on to explain that she's not dead, but she has been petrified. And Filch is all like, ask him, he shrieked, turning his blotched and tear-stained face to Harry. No second year could have done this, said Dumbledore firmly. It would take dark magic of the most advanced. He did it, Filch spatched, his pouchy face purpling. You saw what he wrote on the wall. He found in my office. He knows I'm a... Filch's face worked horribly. He knows I'm a squib, he finished.
I love that because, like, this was the moment that I did the same thing as you did, Andrew. I went back and I was like, am I supposed to know what that means? And then I was like, oh, no. And then, you know, Harry's like, I don't even know what that is. Well, he immediately says, I don't even know what a squib is. And I just think it's so interesting. They must really think, I guess in one perspective, they must really think very highly of Mr. Harry Potter to think that he's capable of this like spell that, you know, he would have no idea about.
So I wonder how much, at least from Filch, and maybe some of this connects to Lockhart too, where Filch is obviously self-conscious about this and he's ashamed of it. And it's an aspect of him that he doesn't like. And so there's this, he's thinking about it all the time, obviously. And other people don't care, don't even know. And so maybe, you know, Filch is projecting, right, onto mm-hmm. Harry and onto some of the other characters, his own insecurities. And maybe Lockhart is doing some of that also. And why Harry? Like, Harry's been stirring the pot since he showed up, you know, in the first book, right? And so he's anything bad must be Harry Potter's doing, right? He's the chaos agent in the school. And maybe that's why Filch is going after him.
Yeah. Oddly enough, it appears, at least in the very beginning, for Snape to be the voice of reason. That, if I may speak, headmaster, said Snape from the shadows. And Harry's sense of foreboding increased. He was sure nothing Snape had to say was going to do him any good. Potter and his friends might have simply been in the wrong place at the wrong time, he said, a slight sneer curling his mouth as though he doubted it. But we do have a set of suspicious circumstances. Why was he in the upstairs corridor at all? Why wasn't he at the Halloween feast? So yeah, not that Snape's doing it in the most impartial manner, but Snape is asking, you know, the relevant questions.
That was a little surprising to me that he kind of came to their defense. But I guess then I was just like, well, that they really must. It's like so sure of themselves. They're like, there's no way, you know, that this could happen. And then I love the mention of the ghosts that they had. There were hundreds of ghosts and they'll tell you where they were. So that's which is, would love to use that someday.
That's the ghosts are my alibi.
Yes.
And so Filch is projecting his insecurities by immediately presuming Harry. And in this way, Snape is projecting his contempt for Harry because he knows Harry's not smart enough to do this.
Oh, that's a good point. Oh, yes. Nice.
And Snape asked a question that we asked in the previous chapter. But why not join the feast afterwards, said Snape. Why go up that corridor? Again, Harry, typical, like, kid, like, not wanting to show all your cards to the adults, is that he won't tell them about the secret voice.
I didn't know how I felt about this. I still don't really know how I feel about this. I guess he doesn't want to seem like a total, like, loon, you know, but like, I don't know what decision I would have made in that moment either. Doesn't Ron eventually say, like, hearing voices in the wizarding world isn't a good thing either? So it's good. Oh, yeah. And then he says, hearing voices no one else can hear isn't a good sign even in the wizarding world. So I guess.
And I think Harry doesn't yet, if I'm remembering right, doesn't yet fully understand what's going on.
No, he doesn't.
Right. So there's a potential, right, that he thinks he's in the problematic sense just hearing voices, right, that there might actually be something wrong. And yet that he doesn't trust the teachers to sort of be honest about, I'm hearing these voices and I don't know if I'm going a little loony or if there's something really happening here.
And of course, Snape cannot maintain his reasonableness for long because the minute he realizes that the trio are withholding something, he tries to take away Harry's Quidditch privileges. And of course, McGonagall, who has a lot of money riding on Harry as the Gryffindor seeker, is not going to have that.
I love that because, like, they have this whole match coming up and he's like, oh, well, probably shouldn't play. And McGonagall's like, no. I just love her love for Quidditch. I might not be the biggest Quidditch fan, but her appreciation for it's pretty funny.
Again, there's another Harry Potter podcast called Binge Mode where it's a common inside joke of theirs that they call her McGallion because she has a secret gambling addiction in regards to Quidditch.
That explains the Quidditch fascination. I see. I like that.
And then Lockhart's just like, oh, I can mix up the, like, reviving draft. And excuse me, said Snape icily, but I believe I am the potions master at this school. Lockhart wants all the attention for himself, and he wants to upstage absolutely everyone. He's harassed Hagrid, harassed Professor Sprout, you know, poor, you know, now Snape. Not that it's poor old Snape, but...
Right.
This point here and the earlier point about the... McGonagall and Snape over Quidditch. I think one of the things I like about these books is the way in which, like, the faculty have lives also. I think there's so many of these books of people being at school written from the perspective of the students where the faculty are sort of one-dimensional and recognizing that the faculty, whatever, maybe they're betting money on Quidditch or they just do it for, you know, for pride or something like that, or that Snape feels, you know, like he doesn't want his toes stepped on by Lockhart doing the potions, that they've got stuff going on, and Filch, you know, is emotional over his cat, that it's not just the students who have, you know, competitions and troubles and conflicts, but the faculty do as well. And sometimes obviously that plays out that the students get wrapped up in that. But I admire that feature of this world, that all the characters are three-dimensional. That it's not just the students' lives are interesting and the faculty lives are background.
I think that's a great point, and that's something that I didn't think about until now, because so often you do see it like these. I mean, I think even as a kid, I remember seeing my teachers as like this, they fit into this role and then they kind of like disappear and they come back and they don't. And I mean, like, that's silly on my part because my mother is a teacher. So I know that's not true, but to give them some kind of interesting little nuances is now I appreciate that much more.
Yeah,
it reminds me of a time where I went to a high school that was different from the high school district that my mother taught, and she taught like high school chemistry. And there was some point I was on my way home and my dad dropped me off to like pick something up or drop something off for my mom. And so I went into her classroom. It was very obvious I was from a different high school because my high school was the very hippie one. So my my bohemian style reflected that. And so I walk in the classroom and I'm just like, hey, here's the whatever. And then I leave. And then my mom, when she got home, she was like telling me, it's like, oh, who was that? That wasn't any girl at that school. And my mom's like, oh, that's my daughter. And she's like, and it's like, you have a hip bohemian daughter?
Nothing
again,
wrong.
They cannot, you know, escape the bubble of, you know, that teachers and by extension professors are just, you unplug them at the end of the day. That's and right. Then you plug them back on.
But we have lives. We don't live in the lockers at the school. We go home right. And we go grocery shopping and, you know, we go to the movies. And I think it's in Hogwarts, right? They're all living. So there isn't going home at the end of the day, right? They're all there 24/7. So it's even more understandable, I think, that the students would see the faculty maybe is more three-dimensional, but maybe not, maybe because they're always in their teacher mode, right? You never see them sort of like, today's my day off.
Right.
They never see them go to the three broomsticks and get wasted.
Exactly. I remember once when I was teaching at another school and I was in a bar at the end, you know, it was a Friday happy hour and I was having a drink and students came in and saw me there and were just like, did a double take. And I was just sitting with some faculty friends and having a beer. I wasn't, you know, like dancing on the tables or anything like that, but the students were still just sort of like shocked. Dr. Mills, what are you doing here? You know, and it was just like, you're not supposed to be here. This is this bar where drinking is students do that, you know, faculty, they teach and then they disappear or unplug or plug themselves back in and don't get drink.
So Dumbledore excuses them before Snape can continue snaping up his snapiness.
What a Snape thing.
And then again, Ron agrees that, yeah, like hearing voices no one else can hear isn't a good thing, even in the wizarding world. Yeah. And so the next few days, of course, that's all the students can talk about is this writing on the wall. And so now everyone is curious about the Chamber of Secrets. And Hermione went to try and check out a Hogwarts of History, but all of them are checked out and she didn't bring hers from home. And so finally, she gets the idea is in their History of Magic class, she asks the Professor Binns about it.
And I loved this.
Go ahead.
Oh, no, I just loved it because it makes me think of, and Dr. Mills, I mean, no offense, I'm a humanities major as well. So like this stuff fascinates me. I would have been in history like, this is great.
Right.
But I love how they kind of like eke out the information and how engaged the students are all of a sudden. I just remember those moments in certain classes where it's like this kind of like something fringy or, you know, just a little darker. We start talking about and you can see everybody's, you know, kind of perk up. And I'm sure, I'm guessing as a professor, you probably are aware of that experience.
Yes. And so more to the, like the, you know, the fact that Binns is just like totally out of it. Like any professor who like all of a sudden the students are perked up and it's like, I want to keep that going. You want to hear about the Chamber of Secrets? I'll talk to you about the Chamber of Secrets. Right. And the fact that he doesn't really care about the students at all, whether they're bored, whether they're excited, sort of, in fact, he doesn't like that they're excited because they're tearing him away from his, you know, from his prescribed lecture, is a deep flaw in his ability as a teacher. There's this movement now in teaching. It's been around for 20 years or more. It's called learner-centered teaching. And I don't know how familiar either of you are with that term, but the idea is, you know, that in teaching a class, you should think about the learners and who they are and where they are and what they might be interested in, what they know and what they don't know and what they might want to know from this information, and design your teaching around them. And if I'm teaching people who know all about the Harry Potter books, I'm going to do something different than if I'm teaching someone who hasn't read them at all. And Binns is what's called a, like, teacher-centered teacher, who's like, here's what I want to say, and I don't care where you are, who you are, what you're interested in, I'm just going to say it. And so in the world of pedagogy, you know, Binns is the exact opposite of what we should be doing. And I get, he's a historian, he doesn't want to talk about what to him are these legends, but there's a way of, right, engaging with the students' excitement and still teaching the subject you want to teach at the same time. So...
yeah, I think Jess and I have explored this in a variety of episodes, just the fact, again, of being more learner-centric, that in like K through 12, you know, things like history and humanities didn't have to be boring if students were given more of a free realm to pursue what elements of history that they would want to study for their research papers or whatever.
Right. And indeed, yeah. to the course I mentioned teaching, right, that this, if students are into Harry Potter, or at least, you know, that many of them more were 10 years ago, you know, okay, if you're into Harry Potter, I can teach you philosophy through Harry Potter, right? And we can talk about the houses, and we can talk about, you know, the experiences, we can talk about the Death Eaters, we can talk about muggles, we can talk about squibs, and we can get to the philosophical topics. And if Harry Potter is the sugar that makes the medicine go down, to borrow from Mary Poppins, then let's do that. And that's exactly what I was trying to do in that class, and what Binns is not doing in his class.
Binns doesn't even know their names. He calls Hermione Miss Grant.
Oh, yes. I love that.
Yeah, that's great. And there's another name he gets wrong.
Like Pavarti Pavtil.
Pennyfeather.
Pennyfeather.
Yeah, that's great.
That's awesome.
So, but they ultimately drag it out of him, where for a few years, the founders worked in harmony together, seeking out youngsters who showed signs of magic and bringing them into the castle to be educated. But then disagreements sprang up between them. A rift began to grow between Slytherin and the others. Slytherin wished to be more selective about the students admitted to Hogwarts. He believed that magical learning should be kept within all magical families. He disliked taking students of Muggle parentage, believing them to be untrustworthy. After a while, there was a serious argument on the subject between Slytherin and Gryffindor, and Slytherin left the school.
Whoa. That sounds like something that I'm like, what am I trying to think of that somebody did that? I don't know. I'm a native Texan, so how many times is there Texas trying to leave the United States? So maybe we're the Slytherins of the United States.
Remember the Alamo?
I cannot speak ill of my home state very much.
But it's interesting that he leaves, and this is at the founding of the school, but there's still his house. It's not like, you know, we had the house for hundreds and hundreds of years. It seems like there's a point at which you could have gotten rid of the house, and it presumably only like a few years into the school. I don't know how, there's no sense of the time here, right?
But not exact time, but you're right. It is within all the founders' lifetime.
Right.
So there was a potential, the opportunity to just forego Slytherin house altogether, and it would just be the three.
Yeah. Yeah.
So interesting. And again, this Chamber of Secrets, as Professor Binns explained, Slytherin, according to the legend, sealed the Chamber of Secrets so that no one would be able to open it unless his own true heir arrived at the school. The heir alone would be able to unseal the Chamber of Secrets, unleash the horror within, and use it to purge the school of all who were unworthy to study magic. And then goes on about there's supposedly a monster in the chamber as well to terrorize all the Muggleborns.
Gosh, it's a little intense. I don't know. Hermione, I'm sure, you know, is freaking out. My lack of familiarity with, you know, I kind of know the basics of the houses, and I'm learning more and more. So it was interesting to get to know, like, the, you know, the Helga Hufflepuff as a Hufflepuff. I know she is referenced in my copy of the Philosopher's Stone. But this was really, I really like this kind of like history and foundation of some of this. Now, I don't know what the Chamber of Secrets is. And if I'm one of the students, I'm just like Hermione, desperate to figure out what is going on with that. But so I'm going to assume there is an assumption. It's probably a contradiction there. The reason that it opened was because of Harry, maybe. I'm sure somebody's going to think that sometime. I don't know.
And already we see in these two chapters that students are already starting to think it.
Yeah. Well, then why didn't it open the year before?
Yes. No, I don't know. You will find out, Jeff. So I think I have a few notes from Andrew's article that I think this is a good place to kind of pause within the two chapters. Basically, the foundation of, again, the house system, you know, derives from the founders. And I think, as I mentioned in the introduction, there have been panels and tons of discussions within the fandom about the problematic elements of the house system. But in a way, if the house system was purely about like highlighting certain personality traits, it wouldn't be as problematic as it is. What makes it so problematic is because of this very specific history with the founders, that now that it's not just personality traits, but unfortunately, because of what Salazar Slytherin did, there are particular elements of ethnic purity and racism embedded within the very nature of Slytherin House.
That's a really nice point, Amy, to distinguish the value of the houses in terms of emphasizing certain personality traits. The Slytherins are ambitious and so on. But that one house seems to be, at least, or Slytherin himself seems to be just a straight up racist. That aspect, and exclusionary, right? And so that there's only certain people for whom magical education should be offered to them. And some people are worthy of being wizards, and some people are not worthy of being wizards. And the worthiness isn't because you know, pass some wizarding test, but it's because of your ancestry, right? If you're pure born, then you're worthy. And if you're not, you're not. That's seeing that aspect of that problematic nature that isn't just about the houses, the division of the houses, but this one particular house and its the purity and the racism that seems to be boiled into the very foundation of the house and the ideology of the house.
Yeah. And honestly, it makes me question, like, the Sorting Hat, like, is it even possible for the Sorting Hat to, let's say there's a muggle-born witch or wizard kid who maybe demonstrates all the personality traits of Slytherin House, but is a muggle-born. So does the Sorting Hat, does he make the decision that I'm going to, like, I'm separating the personality from the specific founder's ideology, which has carried through throughout the centuries, obviously, right, from what we see of, you know, the type of Slytherins that kids that get into Slytherin. Because honestly, in my head canon, I think there's a whole bunch of muggle-borns in Ravenclaw that are technically should be in Slytherin purely based on personality. But I think the Sorting Hat is like being nice and doesn't want to subject the kids to that sort of prejudice. And so I think there's a lot of, you know, would-be Slytherins that are actually muggle-borns that are actually in Ravenclaw.
There's something I find, a parallel I find here, which is this, a parallel between what's happening in at Hogwarts and maybe what's happening in universities and education nowadays, which is an attempt maybe to ignore or paper over this aspect, right? So let's just think of the Slytherins as these are the people who are ambitious. And we can have a debate about whether ambition is a positive character trait or a negative character trait, but let's just assume it's a fine character trait to be ambitious. And those are the Slytherins. I'm sort of shorthanding it, but right, they've got that character trait. But there's this other piece, there's this darker side of Slytherin, which is racist and which is exclusionary. And maybe there's a sense from the Sorting Hat or maybe from everybody else involved with the school that we're just gonna try to push that under the carpet and ignore that. But they ignore it to their peril. And I think maybe that's what's showing up in some of these contemporary debates in universities nowadays about the, you know, racist history of these institutions and where money comes from. And we've been papering over and ignoring. One of the more recent stories is about how Georgetown, some early Georgetown University was founded by Jesuits, and some of the early Jesuits who founded the university owned slaves and sold slaves in order to raise money to help Georgetown University get going in its early days. And this was only recently rediscovered, I think, in the past 5 years or so. And there's been a real effort, right? Discussion at Georgetown. What should we do, right? We have this history, and how do we come to terms with it? And a lot of universities are doing this from taking names off buildings and changing the names on endowments and this sort of thing to confront the problematic past. And it seems that's something that hasn't been happening at Hogwarts, at least not through this part of the Chamber of Secrets book. And I until this discussion, I hadn't really thought of that as the people at Hogwarts, not just the Sorting Hat, but Dumbledore and all the faculty are just trying to not really confront the problematic nature of what's happening with this in the founding, at any rate, of the Slytherin House.
Yeah. Any thoughts, Jess?
No, I just want to hear you talk all about all those things more, because I read your article and when you're talking about the Sorting Hat and kind of the what Amy said, the different attributes of people or, you know, wizards and witches in different houses. I guess I hadn't thought into it that much. I mean, I know that this, you know, I'm thinking about Harry and the whole I don't know, conversation is probably not the right word, that he has with the Sorting Hat, where he says, you could be great there in Slytherin. And he's like, but the hat is like, but Gryffindor, fine. You know,
right.
I kind of think about that. What if he did end up there and just...
Yeah. I mean, one of the things I was doing in the article was sort of like using the houses and the Sorting Hat, right, as a jumping off point for thinking about patriotism and thinking mm-hmm. about loyalty to one's country and the yeah. extent to which there's a fine way in which being patriotic seems not morally problematic because it's like you believe in something more than yourself. And it's, you know, you could think of it as being you're patriotic. Jess, you said you're from Texas, right? So you might be, mm-hmm. you know, a patriotic fan of Texas in a non-problematic way, right? Or of your university when it's time for a game. Or proud that, you know, someone from your state or your school or your town sort of went and did well. And that's sort of good. You believe in something more than yourself, but it can turn into this, and we see this all too often, into this idea that I'm better than you because I'm from this place, this country or this city or went to this school. And that's where patriotism, I think, turns into nationalism. And yeah. it seems that in the houses, there's just the same line that they're all dancing with. Like, yes, the house cup and you know is good. It motivates people to study and get points, and that seems like a good educational goal. But when it turns into right where we're dividing ourselves when we should be uniting ourselves, that's where it's sort of problematic. And it's one thing to be rah rah for your country in the Olympics, and another thing where we're thinking about, I don't know, getting COVID vaccines, and I should all come mm-hmm. to me and my country and screw the rest of you who live in other countries, right? That's where it crosses over into a problematic place.
And that right. is what your article made me think about.
Yeah.
I was like, oh my gosh. First of all, it's totally surprised that it was written 10 years ago. And then I'm reading it and I was like, this could all be applied to our situation right now. And just how interesting
yeah.
that was.
So. Yeah.
Yeah. One element I wanted to point out is you quote Tolstoy in your article, one of my favorite writers. Oh, I love Anna Karenina. And he defines like patriotism as the desire for the exclusive good of one's own nation. And so when you frame it like that, that's definitely highlighting the negative aspects of patriotism. And yeah, if that was his way, now I understand why the Nazis burned War and Peace. Any country's nationalism at the expense of Germany was not to be had. But one thing I wanted to point out, I guess, is how do we define patriotism versus nationalism, because I tend to not use the term patriotism very often. I'm so used to the word nationalism. And I did study in Istanbul, where just purely understanding the modern nation state of Turkey, you have to understand nationalism. And so I understand my understanding of nationalism, it's not, woo, we're so great. It's more, nationalism to me is more, again, you're defining yourself in respect to an enemy, or at least at the very least,
yes.
in respect to another. But my husband, who is also a political philosopher, he's currently writing his dissertation on a political philosopher, Al-Farabi, but he also, you know, outside of that, he was writing a article about another Persian politician, but also like social theorist and guy like that. I think his name was Furughi. And so basically he differentiated between patriotism versus nationalism, where he defined patriotism as the benign, yay, I'm so happy that I'm part of this one group. This group has great attributes, blah, blah, blah. So that's purely benign. And then he defines nationalism as, again, as the thing that defines you as in relation to your enemy.
Mm-hmm.
So he kind of separates those two. The patriotism is the good kind and nationalism is the bad kind. And then right. fascism is the really, really,
really
bad kind.
Really bad kind, right. No, I like that way of thinking about it. And I guess I notice that I think it's hard for people to hold the line at the yeah. good kind of patriotism that I'm happy to be where I'm from or a member of this community. I'm proud of my community. I want to contribute to the community in some way. And it's not about others. It's not about thinking we're better than you. But I'm not a selfish person. I want to help, you know, I could be a patriotic member of my town and want to volunteer at community cleanup days and volunteer at the school or that sort of stuff. And it's not about thinking my town's better than your town, but I find it's a very, very slippery slope. And I'm not a big fan of slippery slope arguments, but it's I think it's a very slippery slope, psychologically slippery slope, to not begin thinking that I'm better than others because I'm from this town or this country. And that's it's figuring out how to hang on to the good kind of patriotism and not let it slide into the bad kind of nationalism. And again, mm-hmm. right, to think about a COVID-related sort of issue, I in the article I draw a sort of parallel, drawing on the work of Martha Nussbaum, a sort of parallel with families and how it's good for parents to like give priority to their own children. That's how it should be. I should care the most about my kids, and other people should care the most about their kids. And so long as all the kids have someone who cares the most about them, then everybody's going to do fine, so long as all the parents can sort of like exercise their care. But then it begins thinking, well, the best for my kids might mean getting some advantages or taking advantage of some advantages that other kids don't have. And that's where things start sliding into a problematic way. Like, how much is it right for me to try to get for my kids? What advantages should I try to get for my kids? So to think about the Varsity Blues case.
Oh, yes.
Right? Mm-hmm. I think it's a perfect example of, yeah, those parents, they should all try to want the best for their kids. Who doesn't want the best for their kids? But now, okay, well, these people have lots of money. And so these people can try to buy their kids admission to USC or Princeton or wherever it was. And it's hard to stop, right? I've got $100,000 and I know someone who can, you know, a swimming coach or a rowing coach or whatever it is. Then you're taking a spot from somebody else. You're giving yourself, your kids unfair advantages. Like I think that's how it shows up in the family context. And I see it happening. I see it happening in my town, the suburb where I live. There's a lot of community pride. There's a lot of quote unquote patriotism about the town. But we live quite right next to parts of. I live in suburban Columbus, Ohio, and we live right next to parts of Columbus, Ohio, which are very economically disadvantaged. And how much is it appropriate for us to be feathering our own nest? Or buying Chromebooks for all our students in the school, you know, because there's money in the community to fund that sort of thing. And is it right to do that instead of taking the money and giving it to other schools where they don't have nearly the advantages that the students in our community have? That's, I think, I don't have good answers there, but I notice that pride in oneself turns into, right, thinking you're more worthy than others, even if you wouldn't say it that explicitly.
Right. And I think that specific, what was her name? Nissenbaum?
Nussbaum.
Nussbaum.
Yeah.
You know, her, again, that sort of, you know, as long as everyone has that one or small group of people that has preferable treatment for them, then it all balances out. That made me think of a variety of debates we've had a bit about the house point system, mm-hmm. because of the disparity between Professor Snape and McGonagall, where Snape is all about the favoritism towards the Slytherin, which to balance that out, which McGonagall should be all about the favoritism towards her own house. But the problem is that she's so impartial and so like, quote unquote, fair, that it should be either both Snape and McGonagall are fair or both of them are totally favorites towards their own house. Then it would be like balanced, but that's not the reality.
Right.
So everything is skewed towards, you know, Slytherin.
Exactly.
Does there ever, like, some of the points that you've made, and again, this is me not knowing, does it ever get to a point where it's kind of, one is viewed as superior? Because I know we've talked about like Gryffindor, Hufflepuff, yeah, the different groupings of people. Is it within the series like preferential treatment, or if you're a Gryffindor, that's thought of more highly than any of the other houses? I haven't picked up on that yet, but maybe I'm just... I mean, I know Harry's in there, so maybe that's kind of like elevates it because of that house. But I guess I know the answer can be, I will see. I'm just curious.
I don't get a sense that, I mean, everybody seems to be affiliated with a house, either because they're now at school or they used to, you know, they're an alum. Mm-hmm. So there doesn't seem to be a sense that I recall of like the... Of certain houses being from the outside privileged. Obviously, you hear a lot more about Gryffindor because that's where Harry is. Right. And I mean, Slytherin House seems to be where the, you know, where some of the baddies are. So they're going to get a lot more attention. But that's my sense. But I haven't read the books for a while, so Amy's probably more expert.
So we get all of that about the Chamber of Secrets. And so they're trying to theorize who could possibly be the heir. And an obvious candidate is, of course, Draco Malfoy. Fits the bill of pure blood from an old family who holds on to those old prejudiced ways. And Hermione's theorizing, you know, how can we trick Malfoy into telling us, oh, we can use Polyjuice Potion, which can, you know, is a potion that can transform us into something else. And I think there actually is an article in the Harry Potter and Philosophy book about the Polyjuice Potion and the sense of transformation and that sort of thing. Well, I'll reach out to that professor at a later date. I think maybe there were spoilers in it that I didn't want to expose Jess to yet, but
I was going to say, I definitely did not read it because I only read the one chapter.
And so the potion recipe is in this one book in the restricted section. And the only way you can get into the restricted section is to have a signed note from a teacher. They're thinking no teacher is going to be dumb enough to like believe their story that they just wanted for like theory or like, you know, just academia. Oh, come on. No teacher's going to fall for that, said Ron. They'd have to be really thick. ...
Yeah.
Yeah.
So really you know who they're going to ask.
Right.
And thus concludes chapter 9. And then we move on to chapter 10, The Rogue Bludger, where they do end up using Lockhart to get the note. And they're kind of, you know, sucking up to him. Andrew, what do you think of Lockhart's teaching method?
I mean, you know, I think I have a bit of the Gilderoy Lockhart about me. I'm not proud of it. And I have a bit of the Professor Binns about me that I'm also not proud of. There's part of it where you're, you know, you're on the stage and all these people are listening to you and looking at you and writing down what you say as you're standing in front of the classroom, and it can get to you, it can go to your head, right? And so I'm not a very self-promotion-y sort of person. In fact, when I was teaching the class I mentioned, I was a little hesitant about having the students read my article because it felt too Gilderoy Lockhart-ish to say, well, here, so you read this thing that I wrote. But I think I'd be lying if I said there wasn't a piece of me that sort of enjoyed, right, the attention and of students. And I think, you know, like Binns is one, a little bit taken to an extreme, and Lockhart is taken to an extreme. So it's nice to see this and remind ourselves we have a little bit of this in us. We professors, maybe all of us do in some sense, self-promotion, and to figure out when it's appropriate and when, again, we should just recognize that it's not about us. And, you know, there's a bit of, I don't know, I think he's got, I'd read him as having a bit of the imposter syndrome and maybe overcompensating for his imposter syndrome with ceaseless self-promotion.
We're especially disparaging of Lockhart for assigning all of his own books because we've all had those professors right. who were their own like 6 books and it's all books they wrote.
That's
and it's
right.
No more than 30% of the reading list should be your own work.
That's right. And my students all think, oh, you make money off this. Like, I'm not. I'm Xeroxing the article for you, right? You're not buying this book. I don't make a dime from the fact that you're reading my article. But even then, I felt sort of sheepish about having them read it.
Mm-hmm. But, of course, Lockhart is flattered enough that he signs the permission slip for the restricted section without even really looking at what it was that what book Hermione wanted.
I love that they're, like, wise enough to kind of not dupe him, but just to, like, know him well enough to just be like, this guy's not even going to read it. Like, take advantage of that situation. Like, you can't really blame him.
Yeah, that's great. And was it Ron who had something? Like, he'll just sign anything if you leave it in front of him long enough. He just sort of enjoys.
Yeah, because I think Hermione, like, wants to keep the note.
Right.
And Ron has to wrench it from her to give it to the vulture-like librarian.
That's right.
So they get the book, which is, what is it? It's Most Potent Potions. And she's kind of going through all the ingredients, and basically they have to break a lot of rules. Like, they have to steal from Snape's private stores. They're, you know, they're brewing this potion that's not appropriate for them to be brewing. They're going to have to sneak into another, you know, house dormitory, which is also not allowed. And so it's a very, you know, stark contrast to Hermione in the first book where she was all rule abiding. And here she's the one that, okay, we're going to have to do this, this, and this. And Ron's just like, this is a lot of rule breaking. And she's like, well, if you're too chicken, I can just turn the book back in right now.
Dang, Hermione, like, yeah. Really turn around there. But she's on a mission. Like, I understand that, like, desire for, like, knowing something. You know, like, she has got to know what this Chamber of Secrets is. She's got to find out some information, and she's going to do it however she needs to do it. So, mm-hmm. I get it.
Yeah,
and I think I'm not the first one in Harry Potter podcast to point this out. It's pretty kind of obvious is the reason why Hermione takes this so much more seriously than the boys is because, unlike the boys, she is muggle-born. So the stakes, right. She is on the chopping block in a way that Ron certainly isn't as a pureblood, and not even Harry is as a half-blood.
Yeah, that this is personal for her. That she's going to be on the outs if the Slytherin approach sort of takes over. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so it's going to have to take a month to brew. And a month, said Ron, Malfoy could have attacked half the Muggleborns in school by then. But Hermione's eyes narrowed dangerously again, and he added swiftly, but it's the best plan we've got. So full steam ahead, I say.
I mean, talk about cool under pressure with Dumbledore. Like, this is the thing with Hermione is, like, she's got a plan and she's going to do it. And it involves breaking the rules or, you know, maybe deceiving a teacher. And she just does what she has to do. Like, Ron and Harry can get a little more emotional in this regard. And she's always got her head about her. I admire that about Hermione.
Yeah. And of course, there's got to be the sort of insurance of having your own ring of Gygus, a.k.a. the invisibility cloak.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
But anyway, so we get off of that and we get into, again, the Quidditch chapter, which... Again, I'm not the biggest fan, but like Andrew said, I don't hate it because, like the last Quidditch chapter in book one, this is serving a purpose because it's not just about beating Slytherin, but then they kick off and are playing the game, and one bludger just will not leave Harry alone, which is completely irregular bludger behavior. The bludgers are not supposed to be partial. They're not supposed to care. They're just supposed to, like, kind of... gravitate towards whoever's closest, I guess. So clearly the bludger has been rigged.
Yeah.
Thinking about who's behind, you know, they always get it wrong about who's behind. In the first book, right, I think they was getting it wrong, if I'm recalling, mm-hmm. who was messing with a Quidditch match, if I'm remembering right.
They thought it was Snape.
Right, it was Quirrell. Not. Right.
Yeah.
And I think here, right, there's always, like, there's the obvious... Snape must be doing it, and it turns out not to be Snape,
or at least someone Slytherin affiliate.
Exactly. Right.
Right. Right.
What I really like is, I mentioned this before, I really like Fred and George's response because, you know, they're typical teenage boys, but at the very least, they're not as obsessed with Quidditch as Oliver. And so they get really mad when Oliver's looking like he's going to listen to Harry's, like, just leave me alone and let me deal with the bludger. Like, I love the way, who is it, Fred or George is like, this is all your fault. Get the snitcher, die trying. What a terrible thing to tell him.
All I could think about is get rich or die trying when they were saying that. And I was like, oh my gosh, it's just, it. But yes, that was, Oliver's a little intense about this. And I kind of read a couple of his things about the match and I was like, calm down. It's a Quidditch match.
You know? Right.
Yeah, and even just for a Quidditch match, I don't think it's fair that, you know, there should be a process where they, to make an inquiry doesn't mean you forfeit, that you have to have a rematch at a later point. So whatever, like, rules are in place, they're not very, you know, accommodating to extenuating circumstances.
And I guess I do appreciate that they're just dealing with it, right? There isn't the going to, you know, complaining, can we stop, something's wrong. They're just soldiering on in what are clearly problematic circumstances, that there isn't a sort of calling Madame Hooch and you know, complaining to her that this bludger is off.
Well, I'm kind of the opposite, where it's like they shouldn't be expected to play under, you know, soldier on in that type of way.
Right.
They shouldn't be penalized for, like, calling that, hey, this bludger is kind of screwy. But
Yeah.
Anyway, so Harry trudges on and gets his arm broken, but still catches the snitch because he's Harry Potter.
Of course, yes. Yeah.
And Harry faints again from, I guess, pain or whatever. And he wakes up and he's like, oh, no, not you.
Oh, yes. Good old Lockhart. He's there to help him out, of course. Out. Anybody, of course. Because who would you want to see at your bedside if something went wrong? Gilderoy Lockhart.
There's the sort of like overconfidence. Maybe I'm wrong in thinking he's got the imposter syndrome. I should take that back. Right. It's this sort of like, I can do it with no evidence that he can.
I kind of wonder like if he's just one of those people that, you know, it's kind of like 50-50, like sometimes it works out. So he just like, you just might as well try. And because it could be like, you know, I don't know what the percentage is, but sometimes it works out. Like if anybody's messing with we've talked a lot about like physical impairment and pain in Harry Potter. And I guess like I would be a little, you know, thank God that they're able to add bones back to your arm and things like that, because that he doesn't do any permanent damage. I don't know if I love that they're just kind of like, well, let's just see what he you know, what happens. I know they're kind of like, we should take him to the hospital wing. And Lockhart's like, no, I got this. And even nobody really trusts that he actually take care of him. So Harry ends up with a boneless arm. How disgusting.
Yeah, and Madame Pomfrey is, and again, trying to upstage Madame Pomfrey on top of everyone else in the school.
Right.
It's sort of like I have a friend who refers to this, he calls it male answer syndrome, where, you know, a question is asked, and if there's a man in the room, the man is going to answer the question and not say, I don't know. this is being afflicted with male answer syndrome. And there's some men who are afflicted with this who work very hard to overcome their affliction. And yes. It seems like Lockhart has whatever the wizarding equivalent is, right? I got a spell for that. I can do it when he can't. There's like no self-awareness of his own limitations and his own incompetence. And he just sort of like trudges on despite his inabilities.
Gosh, I feel like I have the exact opposite of what Lockhart has. Like, I'll probably be like, I don't know if I can do that. So I think being in the middle is probably the way to, the
yes way. we should know what we don't know, right? This is a very Socratic thing, right? Recognize, I'm a philosopher, so I have to talk about Socrates at some point or other, right? Recognize what we know and recognize what we don't know, and have a kind of humility and epistemic humility with respect to what we know. And Lockhart doesn't have any humility at all.
Not at all.
Yeah.
So again, even though it's in with Madame Pomfrey's power to give Harry all his bones back, even in one night, but still it's very, very painful.
Yeah. What does he talk about? Like it feels like splinters in his arm or something.
Yeah.
I'm trying to.
Yeah.
I don't know why she didn't give him a more powerful sedative, but. If she had, then the next thing wouldn't have happened, which is pivotal to the plot, which is Harry gets a nighttime visitor.
Oh, yes. Good old Dobby. I was wondering when Dobby would show back up.
I love Dobby.
What did you think of Dobby coming back?
Oh, gosh. I mean, I love it because it's Dobby. I think Dobby's a great character. I think he's funny. I think he, you know, represents this group. The house elves, I think, are really interesting. His own, like the way he keeps beating himself when he, you know, for doing bad things. I find him really, I mean, not comical in a bad sense. I find him funny and interesting, but also sort of like representative of this very oppressed group of house elves. And he's got all these powers. Like he can get this bludger to, you know, to attack Harry.
Yeah. And he could seal the barriers. So again, going back to my old theory that the whole reason that house elves were enslaved is because the wizards didn't want these very powerfully magical creatures, who's in a lot of ways, their magic can supersede their own. They can't just be walking around free.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah.
I know this is, I know people love Dobby, and right now Dobby just stresses me out. Because like whenever he shows up, Harry's in some drama, or he's like talking about the different ways he's like, oh, I had to iron my hands for that. And I'm like, oh my God, what is going on with you? He stresses me out right now.
I can see that.
But
I can see that.
Yeah. And Harry's like, you know, you better get lost before my bones come back, Dobby, or I might strangle you. Dobby smiled weakly. Dobby is used to death threats, sir. Dobby gets them 5 times a day at home.
I see him as the wizarding Elmo. I think just because he refers to himself by his own first name in the way that Elmo doesn't use pronouns.
In the third person always.
Third person. So like as I read it, I think of like wizarding Elmo.
That's what we should call him, is the wizarding Elmo from now on.
And, you know, I didn't realize this, I guess, in previous rereadings, but just how socially cognizant Dobby is, because Dobby goes into this whole spiel about, Dobby remembers how it was when he who must not be named was at the height of his powers, sir. We house elves were treated like vermin, sir. Of course, Dobby is still treated like that, sir, he admitted, drying his face on the pillowcase. But mostly, sir, life has improved for my kind since you triumphed over he who must not be named. Harry Potter survived, and the Dark Lord's power was broken. It was a new dawn, sir, and Harry Potter shone like a beacon of hope for those of us who thought the dark days would never end, sir. And now at Hogwarts, terrible things are to happen, are perhaps happening already, and Dobby cannot let Harry Potter stay here now that history is to repeat itself, now that the Chamber of Secrets is open once again.
It's a very informed house elf. That's like, right. He knows exactly what's going on. I don't. So I feel envious of Dobby.
I think that's often true of the, you know, people who are in oppressed groups. There's a lot more awareness, I think, than the people who are in the privileged groups recognize.
And I think I mentioned when Dobby first showed up in chapter 2 is the idea that, you know, in the Dark Lord's regime that puts pure blood wizards at the top and just treats human muggle-born citizens, you know, as second-class citizens. So if that's their very low status, then what is the status for even lower than theirs with non-human magical creatures?
Right. Yeah. Dobby's in a poor way, and I think like trying to help but recognizing his limitations, right? His limitations as an enslaved creature, right? He's trying to resist his enslavement and doing the best that he can and suffering because of it, but recognizing that he must, right? And fighting with what he thinks he should do and the punishment he's going to receive because of it. He's a resistor.
Yeah.
Indeed, he's a rebel. So, and then ultimately, before Dobby can spill the beans anymore, he vanishes and he leaves because not the Snape, McGonagall, Dumbledore trio, but just Dumbledore and McGonagall show up in the hospital wing and they seem to be carrying a statue. What did you think of this, Jess?
And it's Colin, right? It's, I didn't know what to think of it. I thought like one petrified thing was like that was going to be it for a while, and then we have a whole person. Poor Colin is petrified. And then, you know, I kind of had this same thought, like, well, this kid's already always has his camera with him. Maybe there's some evidence, but of course not. It is the film melted, and they still don't know, and I still don't know what the Chamber of Secrets is about.
Again, poor Colin, just collateral damage. Just wanted to give Harry some grapes.
Right.
And I didn't remember this from last time. Like, it's a good thing Dumbledore, like, came down for a cup of hot cocoa. # hot cocoa saves lives.
I wondered how, like, I can't remember if it hurts to be petrified or not.
I don't know either.
There are some nights when I think I'll take being petrified if it gets me, you know, my 8 hours of sleep.
Right.
So, like, good for Colin. It's gonna relax.
But again, as Jess said, all the evidence has been melted away. So there's no indication of what or who petrified him.
But now we know Harry's off the hook, or now the teachers, right, know Harry's off the hook for having petrified Mrs. Norris.
Good point.
Is true. What does this mean, Albus? Professor McGonagall asked urgently. It means, said Dumbledore, that the Chamber of Secrets is indeed open again. Madame Pomfrey clapped a hand to her mouth. Professor McGonagall stared at Dumbledore. But Albus, surely, who? The question is not who, said Dumbledore, his eyes on Colin. The question is how. And from what Harry could see of Professor McGonagall's shadowy face, she didn't understand this any better than he did.
Yeah, Dumbledore with the like cliffhanger there. So it isn't who. I feel like he probably already has that figured out, but the how I'm not reading the next chapter yet. So I didn't skip ahead, but I really would like to know what's going on here.
And that concludes chapter 10. So, Andrew, I know you have young children to tend to, so thank you so much for joining us for these two chapters.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thanks for inviting me. It was wonderful to talk to you both about the book, and now I just want to finish the book. I've now been inspired to not just read chapters 9 and 10, but to read the whole book. So,
of course. Have a wonderful night.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye. So we can move on to Gothic Geek Out. What were your elements of the Gothic, Jess?
I mean, I think it's this one, the Chamber of Secrets and kind of the whole story and things around it. That's pretty quintessentially Gothic to me. Just this place that has so much mystery and the horrors within. I thought like this is probably one of the, it's up there in Gothic elements in Harry Potter. What about you?
Yeah, mine, again, also the founder's story, you know, not just the Chamber of Secrets, but the founder's story, because that is definitely delving into Gothometer of Sublimely Gothic podcast. You know, one of our categories that we rank upon is the past. And so this is the ultimate, you know, past is coming to haunt the present, that the nature of the relationship of the founders has completely influenced and in some cases poisoned the way the house system has developed over the centuries.
Right. Yeah. That's a good point and gets to that like real heart of a lot of the Gothic stories.
Yeah. But yeah, it was a very obvious choice for Gothic stuff this time.
Yeah, I feel like it was. It was easy this go around.
And now we can move on to Tarot of the Day. Yeah, I'm shuffling. Okay, let's see. What do I get? Oh, number 8 in the Major Arcana, Strength.
Okay.
So let me pull up the definition. Yeah, the Strength card is usually a woman with like a lion or a tiger, but in my Druid Craft Tarot deck, the creature next to her is a boar.
Oh, that's interesting. Interesting change. I wonder why.
Yeah. So Game of Thrones, when I think of boar, I just think of how Robert Baratheon died.
Sorry, I just was watching something and it made me think of that. Yeah, that's dark. That's what I would say. That's pretty dark.
Okay. The Strength card represents strength, determination, and power like the Chariot. However, while the Chariot signifies outer strength and will, the Strength card speaks to the inner strength and the human spirit's ability to overcome any obstacles. Strength is about knowing you can endure life's obstacles. You have great stamina and persistence balanced with underlying patience and inner calm. You are committed to what you need to do, and you go about it in a way that shows your composure and maturity.
I'm going to give Dobby the Strength card. I feel like that's really applicable to Dobby on this, because like we talked about in our conversation, how he does things that he knows are going to result in his own pain and suffering, but to kind of help the greater good. So I think that's demonstrative of some great strength.
Yeah. And I also want to give the Strength card to Hermione, because she's also in this chapter is just like, okay, this is what we got to do. We're going to break some rules, but we're going to do it and you're going to like it.
Power to her, getting it done.
Yep. So, and again, definitely showing like the inner strength, like the not so much the physical strength, but the composure and maturity bit for Hermione.
Yes, absolutely.
And then finally, the other thing I can think of is, again, Harry in the Quidditch match. Not that I tend to be in the camp where someone shouldn't be put in the position of having to endure something like that and not have to, you know, being forced to suck it up or whatever. But the fact that he does, he's like, okay, I'm just going to deal with this. And I know it's not fair, but I'm just going to deal with it and get it over with and deal with it and get the snitch despite this crazy bludger.
Yeah, good for him. I work with some people that are the opposite of that. So good for him. Just getting it done.
Alrighty then. And also, in addition to tarot card, I got a little birthday present for myself because my birthday is coming up.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So, big one. Are you familiar with the Nordic runes?
I am familiar in that I know what they are, but I don't, like, if you handed some to me, I would not know what to do with them or how to read them.
Okay. So I'm going to, you know, throw my Nordic runes and I'm going to pick one. And then again, read the definition and do, again, same thing as with tarot.
Cool.
And the rune I picked up is the one that is shaped like an R. So let's see. One moment. It's called the Radho rune.
Okay.
Meaning journey, physical or spiritual. Seeing the bigger picture, change, reunions, travel represents the wagon wheel. If your journey is physical, this is a good sign. However, if your journey is spiritual, you need to be adaptable. See the right move for you to make and actually do it. Focus on the experience, not the destination. Some interpretations reference the return of old friends or the appearance of those you made a soul pact with before coming to this life. Other interpretations believe the wagon wheel is representing the seasonality of nature of the wheel of the year. Recognize the seasons can be abundant or can wane. If you're feeling low, remember that you will not feel this way forever and beautiful, joyous days are ahead of you.
Interesting how they kind of complement each other a little bit in some respects. The seasonality, like the different seasons, not so much, but I think there's like an element of strength maybe that I heard. I also was just trying to take in all this new information because this is so unfamiliar to me. So what do you think about the one that you picked?
It's a little hard because again, this is just so brand new to me. I'm so used to the tarot meeting. So again, it seems the biggest one is journey, physical or spiritual. So in terms of journey, again, we can talk about, you know, Harry's journey in the sense of the stakes just got higher and Colin got petrified. So now he's definitely, if he didn't already have an investment in what was going on, I think he definitely does now. Because I certainly was. Because even if I was annoyed, if I had like a sort of geeky, like president of a fan club, if I was a celebrity, I'd still feel bad if something like bad happened to them while they were trying to like do something for me.
Of course. Yeah. Yeah. Yes, absolutely. And poor Colin, he's just like, it seems like he's just on the like periphery of some of Harry's mood swings too. But yeah, interesting. I like this new exercise. I feel like I'll be learning something too. So that's cool.
Yeah. Alrighty then. And then finally here, let me put away my rune. Yeah, I actually bought them from an Etsy shop in some lady in Louisiana.
Oh, ooh.
Yeah, for as much as I, you know, use Amazon Prime and stuff like that, I'm trying to, you know, support small businesses more.
I am trying to do that as well. So I love Etsy for that.
Alrighty then. And now we move on to fan fiction time.
Mine is probably like really not that exciting, but what if the kind of the lore of the Chamber of Secrets was more well known? I guess especially to the students. Like, what if they just kind of knew? So it made me think of when I was in school, we had different ghosts. I went to a really old school and a lot of students had been through that school. It was old and not that super nice at the time. I don't know. It could be great now, but just kind of, we knew about different things that happened. I was a theater student, so specifically in the theater, the ghosts in the theater. I know this is like Hogwarts has ghosts. It's not it's like just something that's there. But the Chamber of Secrets is pretty intense and it feels like new information to a lot of
students.
Yeah. Yeah.
I feel like if it was more well known that Andrew was talking about, that there would be more pressure for the faculty or maybe wider like Wizarding Society or whoever's involved in education to confront the problematic elements of the Slytherin house.
That's a great point. Yeah. Rather than just kind of dodge it or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm fine. Again, after talking to Andrew, just so much parallels between like Slytherin and like the Confederate flag and things like that.
I'm so glad you said that, because I was thinking about some of those things and I was like, I don't know if I should go down this path. But, and I don't, you know, again, I think I'm trying to hold my judgment on some of the houses because I just don't, it's all, a lot of it is new information to me. I have very surface level knowledge of this right now. So when we wrap up the series, I bet I will have my mind made up a little bit more, but I apologize for my rambling. What was your fan fiction that you thought of?
Again, from what Andrew mentioned, as he said, you know, Slytherin, the guy, left in his lifetime. So they could have kiboshed Slytherin altogether. So what would it have looked like had there just been three houses?
Do you think, you mentioned like the Ravenclaws and some of the Slytherins, like kind of being assigned Ravenclaw. Do you think that would have been the house that had a little bit more of those traits? I don't think you can eradicate like the traits that Slytherins have. It's just
really, yeah, like the reason I put Ravenclaw, because Ravenclaw is the closest to Slytherin in the sense of both Ravenclaw and Slytherin show the sort of moral ambiguity and moral gray area of life, whereas as much as we love Gryffindor and Hufflepuff, you know, and very much steadfast in their morals and stuff, the reality is, you know, sometimes, like maybe like people in power, sometimes they do really have to do really bad things for the greater good. And in the way that, you know, part of it is about, I know I'm going to have to do this and I'm going to have to carry the burden on my conscience, knowing that I have to do this because no one else can or will, and it will, you know, create better opportunities or the resolution to people in a situation that can't help themselves.
Yeah.
So in a way, that's like a good element of the moral ambiguity of Slytherin and by extension Ravenclaw, because Ravenclaw is purely like intellectual pursuit and it doesn't have any morality attached to it, and showing that, you know, Quirrell in Deep Potter Trivia is not a Slytherin. He's a Ravenclaw.
Interesting. I didn't know that. That's something I'm curious about, and I'm sure the information is there. I just need to seek it out. It's just like where the specific teachers were and their career at Hogwarts, like their schools or their houses. Anyway, just thinking to myself there.
And then for Andrew's fanfic speculation that he shared before he left, what if Harry hadn't like made it back to school, or more specifically with these chapters, what if the rogue bludger had succeeded in injuring Harry to the point that he didn't just stay in the hospital wing, but he had to go like to the magical hospital, St. Mungo's?
Great question. I guess he wouldn't have encountered, I mean, maybe Dobby wouldn't have gotten to, you know, I'm sure Dobby would have felt more awful and also wouldn't have been able to have a conversation with him. I wouldn't think, I don't know. Dobby seems to find his way to Harry.
Yeah, somehow, if he can get into Hogwarts, he could get into the magical hospital.
He's a clever house.
Yeah, I don't think that would change. I think it's more everything would happen as it is. It's just naturally Ron and Hermione would be on their own and Harry would go back to school and just be like, oh, hey, fill me in. What happened?
So, yeah, so Ron and Hermione might have had the information before Harry, and then I'm sure, you know, would have been able to dive into that research a little bit sooner. I mean, I think I know Hermione would have. And why doesn't she just mail her parents and say like, hey, can you please send me my book? Maybe she did and she's just can't wait. I don't know.
And that concludes this episode. Tune in next time where we will go over chapters 11 and 12, The Dueling Club and the Polyjuice Potion. It's in these chapters where we shall be joined again by Amanda and Kevin Wilson from the Fox and the Foxhound Love, Marriage, and Harry Potter podcast.
Very excited, not excited to feel like the Harry Potter ding dong again, but I love their conversation. So I'm happy to be like a bystander in this conversation.
All right, then catch you guys later. Bye.
Bye.